welcome to Rabble Radio. It's the week of Friday, December 10th. I'm your host and the editor of Rabble.ca, Chelsea Nash. This week on the podcast, Rabble contributor Brent Patterson interviews Wet'suwet'en land defenders Eve Saint and Jocelyn, or Jossie, Alec. Eve and Jossie are sisters who have been arrested and criminalized for defending their sovereign territory in northern British Columbia from a fracked gas pipeline being built on those lands without consent. Eve was arrested by the RCMP on February 7th, 2020, at the Guy Demden checkpoint blockade at the 44-kilometer mark on the Morris River Forest Service Road. There were 60 to 100 police officers present at that time, including the emergency response team, dressed in army green and carrying automatic weapons. Before she was arrested, Eve said to the officers, quote, "This is Wet'suwet'en territory. We are unarmed. We are peaceful. This is unceded territory. This is the territory of Wu's. I am his daughter. You are invaders. You are not allowed here. You are not welcome." Eve was charged with obstruction of justice and held in custody for 4 days. More recently, Jossie, her sister, was arrested by the RCMP on November 19th, 2021, while inside a cabin at Coyote Camp near the 63-kilometer mark on the road. That cabin was built on the Martin Forest Service Road near Morris River to stop Coastal GasLink from drilling under the river to lay the pipe for its pipeline. Jossie was inside the cabin when the RCMP used an axe and then a chainsaw to tear down its front door as an ERT officer pointed an automatic weapon at those inside. Journalist Michael Toledano filmed this dramatic footage of the assault, and you may well have seen that. If you haven't, I recommend you do watch it. It's quite dramatic. Jossie was charged with civil contempt for breaching the terms of an injunction granted to Coastal GasLink and not released from custody until November 23rd. Eve has said, "The post-traumatic stress is real. As Indigenous peoples, we don't like to see these images of our relatives and loved ones being invaded with these colonial forces." Take a listen to these two powerful women as they discuss their experiences defending their land with Brent.
Jossie, it's certainly been very much in the news lately, the RCMP raid that happened just 3 weeks ago. As I understand it, you were at Coyote Camp where the second day of the raid happened. I think many people will have seen some of the video that happened on that day. And I wonder if you could take just a few moments to describe a little bit of your experience from that, or what you would like people to know about what happened that day.
That day when the RCMP and the ERT started coming down the hill, I knew that was expected, you know, and I gotta admit, I was a little scared because of like the guns that were being held and the dogs that were being brought down. And when they started coming out of nowhere and just seeing like the guns being aimed at us, the snipers. And yeah, we just stood there in our cabin, myself, my partner, and two other allies that decided to stand with us, which we're grateful for. It was pretty intense and just being like surrounded. And there's this one point where my partner, because there's two Greens that were standing in front of the door and they started like backing up really slowly with their guns drawn on the door. And like through what went through his mind is that they're going to blow the door open. So he grabbed me and the two allies that were with us, they're a couple, and he grabbed her and they like covered us. And we like, my heart started racing, you know, I started shaking, thinking that they were actually going to blow the door open. That didn't happen, thankfully, but yeah, that was just like pretty scary. So we started like keeping an eye on them again. And they went into behind the hill area, and them too, they had their guns drawn on us still, like waiting for us to walk out or like make the wrong move so they could like pull the trigger. Leading up to that, the cops were surrounded us too, and they were inspecting the cabin, and they did not not read us the injunction. They just pretty much told us that we're not following the Canadian law and they're going to come in and arrest us. And if we didn't comply, then they'll break down the door and drag us out. And that's what they did. And so with that happening, well, first they used an axe, our axe, for chopping wood. That's what we used it for. So they used that and they still told us that if we didn't come out of the cabin, then they would start chainsawing through the cabin. Like, we did not know which area that they would start chainsawing. So we got in the middle of the room and so they started the chainsaw and they still like were using the axe to break down the door, and they so happened to like catch the bottom of it. So the bottom came out first and it like went out towards them, the door. And so, yeah, we were on our knees. We had our hands up. We like told them that we were unarmed and still they had their guns drawn. Like, the first person that they like did it to was me. Like, they had their guns like right there. And they had the canines and like I could still like hear the growls and like the barking. And yeah, they said that if we didn't come out still, then they would drag us or send in the canines. And so my partner looked at me and we were just looking at each other and I was like, okay, I'll go first. So I walked out and that's when the rest followed me and that's when we got arrested. And they didn't like really read us our rights or anything when we got arrested. They just told us that we were arrested. And so we started like walking up halfway up the hill, but they stopped us because they were like concerned that half of them would not make it up the hill because it was like such a big hill. So we stood there for like a good hour or so and they came with a grader and a bulldozer and they started like making a road. And so they did that and they brought down the police vehicles. And yeah, that's when they finally started like questioning us and put us in the cop car. And yeah, that's when they hauled us off into the paddy wagons and we were all just in there all squished together. And the people that got arrested first at Coyote Camp were placed in the paddy wagon first and they had the heat blasted with all their snow gear on. And so they had to wait a good 2 hours. And that was like just straight up torture from the beginning.
I had understood Coyote Camp as that space where Coastal GasLink is setting up to drill under Wet'suwet'en River. So I guess there's different cabins on that site?
Yes, Coyote Camp was on top of the hill and just a bit down on the so-called drill site is where me and my partner's cabin was built and we were living in there. As we were locked up, CGL and the RCMP decided to burn our cabin down with our belongings in it. And that was just straight up devastating because we had to find that out in court. And the RCMP tried lying, saying that there was a big fire near the cabin, but the fire was like not close enough to the cabin to catch on fire. So, you know. Yeah. When our cabin was being overtaken, like my partner and I were informing the RCMP and ERT that they were trespassing on Wet'suwet'en territory and they needed a warrant to come in. And we let them know that we had every right to build on our territory and that they needed to leave. But obviously they didn't listen. So they violated Wet'suwet'en law by ripping Indigenous women off their own territory.
Yeah, no, thank you for going through that again and sharing that with us. Eve, maybe I can ask you. So you were arrested the previous year in February 2020. How did your experience compare to Jossie's, or what would you want to share of what you had to go through?
Yeah, hearing Jossie's story, it makes me emotional because she's my little sister. So, I mean, me not being able to be there to stand with her or protect her, it just really hits in the heart. So I'm kind of tearing up and emotional because I know what she went through. You know, getting the news that 100 RCMP are headed up your way a 55 convoy, heavy machinery are heading up your way and they're coming for you. And when she talks about like the RCMP just wanting to pull the trigger, I know that feeling. We had snipers pointed at us too. We had smirks. I had big RCMP men look at me with hate in their eyes. They're grilling me. And it's like, wow, you're really looking at a woman like that? That's how you get your power? That's how you think, like, you know, you're a man, you have to hurt a woman, you want to kill me. I could see it in your eyes. And this is how RCMP view Wet'suwet'en women. This is what we witnessed in the past few years. And so going back to when I was arrested, the raids started happening with other camps. They raided Camp 39, and that camp was set up to bring us supplies, and we were behind a blockade. And so they started off entering 39, and then it kind of just tumbled from there. And then next thing you know, like, we don't know when they're coming or what they're going to do. And like Jocelyn said, because I can relate, like, you can't make any sudden movements or else they will shoot you. Like, I was the police liaison. And also because it's my father's territory, that I wanted to be the one to talk with them and to let them know that that's WASA's territory and that we are under Wet'suwet'en law and we have every right to be there. And so, like, I remember just being like, don't make any sudden movements. And my partner too stood with me, like, just like Jossie. And he was like, be careful how you point that feather in your hand, because I had an eagle feather. And an eagle feather, like, that is sacred to, like, Indigenous people. And I felt like, oh my God, I didn't even think about that, because I was pointing it at them. And then he's like, don't do that. Don't do that. They're going to shoot you. They're going to shoot you. And, like, unfortunately, like, I hate to say this, but I was pregnant at the time. And you know what? I didn't want to have to be there, but I had to, because there was just too much at stake. And I knew that, like, if I left, I would regret it. You know, I was going, like, thinking, like, in the future, if I asked my daughter, like, would you have wanted me to stay or would you have wanted me to go? And I know that my daughter would have been like, I would have wanted you to stay. And, like, it's a hard thing to do. It's not easy to be like, okay, I'm going to make a stand. And I'm so proud of my sister for making her stand this year. And it just fills my heart, Jossie. I love you and I'm so proud of you, and the ancestors are proud of you, and that you know, like, you'll always carry that. And think about that when you go through hard times, when you go through post-traumatic stress, because you're going to. You and you know what, if this happens again and you see images and you're not able to go there because you have your own family, like, you're going to go through post-traumatic stress too as well. So there was a lot happening at our raid too. And I, you know, I felt the ancestors with me, like, when, even when I had that eagle feather and, you know, it was like, I was, you know, not obviously not in conversation with the RCMP, but yelling at them, telling them that they're the ones who are killers. They're the ones who are criminals. We are not criminals. We're not armed. We haven't killed anyone. We haven't stolen any children. We haven't stolen any lands or resources. So who's the criminal? And so I'm like, we're here because of your kin and your grandchildren too as well. I held that feather and it's what kept me grounded. And we helicopters came flying in, they dropped TAC teams and canine units and bomb squads, and we made our stand on the bus. So as they were coming from both ends, me and my partner went on the bus, and we had two fellow Indigenous kin up on top of the bus on a platform, Anne and Denzel. And so, you know, we tried to hold as long as we could. I know that I wasn't able to make a stronger stand because I was pregnant. So when they finally figured out that they could just open the door, because we didn't lock it. we effing forgot about that. Anyway, so they finally figured out how to open the door, and then they came in, and you know, they did read us the injunction. They're like, "Do you comply?" And we were just like, we're silent. And they came in the bus, and my partner got up to try to protect me, but he was like, he can't make a move because, you know, they're going to hurt us. So then they came to me and they're like, you know, leave. I didn't say anything. As soon as RCMP touched my elbow, I'm like, okay, I got up and like, I can't, you know, be tasered. I can't be kicked. So I left and I was, torn off my territory. And what came to mind was genocide. All the people before me not being able to go on that land because pipelines are going to be built, because people are going to have conditions that they can't go back on that territory. And so we have that severed, we have that identity, that part of ourselves that have the right to like be on the lands and to collect medicine, or even, you know, just to be Indigenous on our lands. We have that connection, that spirituality being out there. We have like our DNA goes back hundreds and thousands of years. And so to cut that connection off because of a pipeline, like you are cutting like healing, generations of healing for future generations. Like they wanted to give me conditions the same as Jossie. They, you know, tried to manipulate me into signing these conditions, saying that I'm not allowed back on the territory unless I'm trapping, hunting, or something cultural and traditional by definition of RCMP and CGL. So like that is just so crazy to me, because they can come and harass me. We see how much harassment is already on the territory anyway, right? With Molly and with like my sister and the other Indigenous people and allies that are there out on the territory. And so like, I'm gonna go out there. I'm not allowed to be out there. My daughter is not allowed to be out there. My partner is not allowed to be out there. Like, where is our healing? Where I made such a connection with that land. Like, I go visit that land more than my dad. I get to spend time out there. Sorry, Dad. True. But yeah, I just kind of wanted to just share that. You know, I'm proud of what we've done, because you know what? Like, we helped other people stand up. We helped other Indigenous people see their power. We did that without being armed. We did that with our voices and our body and our medicine. And we were able to hold ground while they came in with guns, you know, pointed, ready, canine units ready to like attack. So I mean, just there's a lot of power in that, and I know this isn't over, right? Like there's still other ways that we're fighting this pipeline. And we just would like to thank all the supporters out there, all the allies, and know that this isn't over. And even keeping up all your solidarity actions, that really helps and puts on pressure. Like RBC, we're targeting investors now. We're targeting RBC and KKR in the States and AIMCO here, like private and public investors. So if you can get your boots on the ground, organize, and it's not over.
No, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Jossie, I'm wondering if I could ask you just, I mean, there was the RCMP raid in 2019, the one that your sister just described in 2020. You would be at least somewhat familiar with what that state violence looks like. I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about where you found that strength to be present in a very difficult situation.
So I was in school 2 years prior to this. And once my sister got arrested back in 2020, that's where it like began. And, you know, I was in school, I dropped everything, went to the front lines with the chiefs, one of the chief's daughters, and, you know, just got that opportunity to like be at the front line to the chiefs. And I started like talking about it more in school. And like, the more I talked about it, you know, the more I got inspired. Later on down the road, my second year of school, you know, it was going well, but like at the end, things took a turn. And that's when everything that was started happening at Coyote Camp, with the arrests happening. And I was like sitting at home and watching when the RCMP was using pain compliance on one of the supporters, and not pain compliance, like torture. And I had this feeling like, I can't sit at home. I can't watch this, you know, like that's my dad's territory that they're defending. And so like, actually for a while, like I kept telling my friend, I was like, the Yint is calling my name, like the Yint is calling my name. And, you know, and like, I gotta be out there. I have to be out there. And I even like texted my sisters, like, I have to be out there, you know, like I want to be out there. And so I reached out and, you know, I left on September 30th. And from the beginning, I was quite like, what am I getting myself into, type of thing. But then I started like just warming up to everybody, because I'm like kind of the shy type. And, you know, I got to like meet every single person out there that's supporting and like putting all their hard work on defending our dad's territory. And so, you know, I got to create this incredible bond with everybody there. And yeah, it's very amazing.
Maybe as a last question, and maybe sort of directed to both of you, let us say someone is listening to this podcast and maybe was generally aware of this, but now is even more aware in terms of this struggle for sovereignty and respect and against police violence, and want to be engaged for the first time, want to get engaged. If they wanted to make a material or a financial donation, where would they go to do that?
Yeah, there are social media and websites that you can follow. You can follow Gidimden Checkpoint at yintaaccess.com, and that will pull up their website, that will give you ways on how to act or donate, even come to camp. If you want to come to camp, there's a process on getting you there, because they're actually still calling for people to go to camp, because the people who are removed, they have conditions that they can't go back. So there is a need to hold space at Gidimden Checkpoint. And Twitter, I believe, is at Gidimden. And Instagram, no, this one's very important. Instagram is yintaaccess. That one is the correct Instagram for Gidimden Checkpoint and the front line. So there's another page that might throw some confusion, but yintaaccess.
So maybe we'll wrap there. But again, I just wanted to thank you both very much for your really clear telling of what happened and what we all need to do to help. So thank you both for your time and for this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
That was Rabble contributor Brent Patterson interviewing Wet'suwet'en land defenders Eve Saint and Jocelyn Alec. Thank you to all three of you for doing that interview and allowing us to hear your story. Now it's time for the segment we call In Case You Missed It. This week at Rabble, in case you missed it, there was a new report from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives that showed just how much higher the risk of contracting COVID-19 is for Indigenous racialized workers, senior national politics correspondent Carl Nirenberg reports. The new report does an analysis of jobs that require close physical contact with others and where risk of infection is highest. This includes jobs in health and long-term care, retail and warehousing, and food processing. Here, the researchers' gaps are striking. They identify not only a race and ethnicity gap, but also a gender gap. Indigenous women had the highest share of employment, making up over 30% of the workers, in occupations that ranked as most dangerous and risky due to the physical proximity to others these roles demand. Next were non-Indigenous women at 28%, followed by Indigenous men at 14.6%. Non-Indigenous men had only a 12.5% share of these dangerous and risky jobs. Racialized workers held well more than half of those roles at 57%. Those are jobs that to some degree have what the CCPA describes as close proximity to others included in them. It is interesting to note that white women worked these jobs at almost as high a rate as racialized workers. On the other hand, a third of racialized men and only 28% of white men worked in such high-risk situations. Overall, the CCPA notes that, quote, the fault lines of the pandemic have been drawn between low-wage and high-wage workers, between women and men, between those who could safely work from home and those who risked infection at work, between Indigenous peoples and settlers, and between racialized and white Canadians. It's these exact systemic disparities that authors Karen Marie Ella Perry and Sheila Avisa say are being brushed aside in our government's ongoing pandemic response. Why are we being asked, they wonder, to return back to normal or to build back when normal is what got us here in the first place? Why are we being told that the pandemic is over because businesses have reopened? Meanwhile, new variants are spreading rapidly across the globe, and the majority of the global south is left without access to vaccines. Quote, whether driven by a focus on the economy above the well-being of workers, white supremacy's refusal to acknowledge the pandemic's ongoing impacts on racialized communities, or toxic masculinity's tendency to conceal vulnerability and push through the emotional pain of the pandemic, gaslighting is culturally systemic, they write. Also this week, writer and land defender Kelly Tatham writes about her decision to divest her personal funds from the Royal Bank of Canada due to its involvement in funding fossil fuel projects like the Coastal GasLink project currently being pushed without consent through Wet'suwet'en land. There's absolutely no reason to continue letting the big banks use our savings to bulldoze through Indigenous rights and fund the destruction of the planet, Tatham writes. Even if there isn't enough money in your account to make a measurable difference in fossil fuel project investments, closing your account sends a message and creates a ripple effect, both inspiring others to do the same and empowering you to take on more tangible actions in your day-to-day life, Tatham writes. She encourages others to take similar action. Finally, Stephen Wentzel reports that Canada has been failing children living in impoverished conditions across the country for decades. At the current rate, childhood poverty won't be eradicated until the 2070s, according to a recently published report from the group Campaign 2000. The report concluded Canada has over 1.3 million children living in poverty, making up nearly one in five children. And yet, between 2018 and 2019, just 24,170 of those children were lifted out of poverty, and that represents less than 1% of Canada's impoverished youth. That's it for this week. If you like the show, please consider subscribing, rate, review, share it with your friends. It takes you a few seconds, but it is invaluable to independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. And if you'd really love to make our day, you can support us directly by making a donation at rabble.ca/donate. You make indie media happen, and we're so grateful for it. Thanks to our producer, Brianne Doyle, to Brent Patterson for contributing this week's interview, and to Eve Saint and Jossie Alec for coming on the show. I'm your host, Chelsea Nash. Thanks for listening to Rabble Radio. I'll talk to you next week for our final episode of 2021.